What's happening? That was bad. Carson Brevard's with us. We're moving on. We're forgetting that happened.
I have no comment about that.
Run it up. Hour number two. We're talking about basketball in this hour because we talked about football for the last hour, so it's only the right thing. And, of course, that means Carson Brevard is
here. SEC basketball, Paul?
That is incorrect, and Carson probably has no idea what that means because he's from California. Carson, what are your impressions of what Justin just did?
I mean, I loved it. I thought that it was... I loved the tone that it set for this next hour, if I'm being honest. I didn't understand it, not even close. I don't have a prayer of knowing what that was, but I really enjoyed it.
Justin slaps both hands down on the floor and sets up in the defensive position. All right, so we were going to talk about a lot of different big things in basketball, and we're still going to do that. We got you for the next hour, but I do want to start with the Chicago Bulls announcing today that they are going to be the recipient of the coaching services of Billy Donovan, which is kind of a shock move because I didn't think Billy Donovan was the kind of coach who wanted to be a part of a rebuild right now. But also, the Bulls might not be in rebuild mode anymore. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's interesting because if you look at some of the strengths of Billy Donovan, obviously one of the signature aspects of this year's Thunder team was just how hard they played, how strong their winning culture and composure as a team was. And I think that is one thing that Donovan really brings to the table. And if you're looking at one team that has the requisite talent to at least be a solid, competitive NBA team, yet has been an abomination for a couple years due to complete incompetence culturally, the Chicago Bulls are the poster children of that. To go from the Garpax leadership and Jim Boylan at head coach to Carson Ovis, who was a really respected general manager talent, and Billy Donovan, who has had tremendous success at this level as a head coach, I think that's the kind of thing that can lift a core that is undeniably flawed. Zach LaVine cannot be the best player on a very good team. Lauri Markkanen has some serious things that he needs to work out just as far as how he approaches the game. He's way too passive. Wendell Carter Jr., we saw seemingly regress a little bit this year, deal with injury issues, so there's all these things that still need to be worked out, but at the very core of it, when you have a coach that these guys believe in, who inspires them to play hard, who can understand and connect with them, that's the most important thing, because these guys actively disrespected Boylan last year. He was a joke, and I don't think Donovan is any schematic genius, which certainly would be helpful for this Bulls team, but the most important thing is just having a guy who they believe in, and it's interesting for me that Donovan wants to take on this gig. He must really believe in the talent and think that there's something that he can build here in a relatively short time because, yes, they have young talent, but they're guys who have been around for a few years, so they're ready to start competing now.
So you know exactly how young this team is, though, when you look at their cap table, right? Zach LaVine, he's making about $20 million a year. Okay, do you want to guess who the next highest paid three players on the Bulls roster are?
Thomas Satoransky.
That is correct.
Oh man, they're not going to be good players.
They're not.
Could it be, I was going to say Wendell Carter Jr. on his rookie deal just because he was taken high, but I think that that's overly ambitious.
Do you just want him?
Tell me, but I'm going to be upset that I didn't get all of them.
So Thad Young is making $13 million.
Oh, of course.
Satoransky at 10, and Christian Felicio, who got paid by Garpax in one of the worst moves of their tenure as the Bulls front office duo, is making $8.15 million next year.
That's unbelievable. I thought about saying him, and then I thought, no way.
I still don't understand why. He was one of the contracts from that crazy summer still, right? No. They paid him after the inflated cap. Felicio's a guy who's only 27 and still hasn't really actually played, so the fact that he made that much money is ridiculous. The point being here, and I want you to denounce the stupidity of what I'm about to say vehemently, but also also entertain it. So what is this team's ceiling if Anthony Davis wins a title in LA and says, I'm coming home, we're going to Chicago, Billy Donovan, that's my boy, and we're going to run it up in the Windy City? Does having Billy Donovan make them a championship team?
I vehemently denounce what you just said, but I will also entertain it. No, it doesn't make them a championship team. What are you talking about? look at what AD is fantastic. He he's not a LeBron-level ceiling raiser. Like, he had some good teams in New Orleans, obviously not That's great true. Teams, but he had an all-star-level guard alongside him in Drew Holiday for years, and they got out of the first round of the playoffs once. This team is still hugely flawed. Yes, if you give LaVine a pick-and-roll partner like Anthony Davis, I think he becomes a lot better because he has improved as a decision-maker, although he's still not great. Maybe you get him to compete hard on defense. He ramped up the effort a little bit there early this season. But no, this core is still so young, and there's talent there, but a lot of it is unproven talent. Like, Lauri Markkanen took one of the biggest steps back this year I've ever seen from a player. He was so passive, and I understand that the numbers say he's a more efficient shooter from three than from two. I do think that he only shot like 34% from three this year. We do need to keep that in mind. He's not Kat. He's not Kristoff. He's not that level of elite shooter. And early on, I always think back to the first game of the season when he was aggressive. He was getting downhill. He was handling and attacking from like inside 18 feet off the dribble. It was awesome to watch. And then he turned into just a spot-up shooter. And that kind of guy can't be the second or third best player on a championship team. Zach LaVine can't be the second best player on a championship team. I think what this team needs to focus on is winning 30, 35 games, maybe sneaking into an 8 seed, and even if they were somehow miraculously to get AD, which will not happen, they would still, to me, be maybe a 6 seed. Because, again, AD isn't the kind of guy that can dominate an entire regular season. He can't make up for the fact that they have poor decision-makers on the perimeter, and he also can't fix all of the structural problems with this team culturally, which maybe Donovan will remedy, but again, that remains to be seen. And then also with how these guys just approach the game of basketball. So I was high on the Bulls train a couple years ago. I think I picked them to win 38 games or something going into the 2018-19 season, and they won 22. And this year was more of the same. It was just an incredible underachievement, and I don't think that all falls on Boylan.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It falls on an entire organization. It's an uber-talented team. You like the guys that they have, right? Especially if Otto Porter is going to be a part of this core, which they have to make a decision on him this offseason. But it feels odd that Donovan would choose this team because there are so many openings on more readily contendable teams, if that's a word, than this one. He could have gone to the Pacers.
Mm-hmm. I think he must really like the talent that they have in Chicago because there, I guess, there's obviously more room to improve with this team. And if he believes that him coming in there is what unlocks that ceiling, the Pacers are kind of set as what they are. You know, they already have a really strong culture and a strong identity, and they established that throughout this season. So he can't add as much there. And maybe in Chicago he sees a situation where if he adds a couple more veteran presences, and again, they need more talent on this roster, but maybe he can do something like what he did in OKC, where people were expecting them to, well, first of all, a lot of people were expecting them to tank, but not many people were predicting them to be a playoff team, and not only were they a playoff team, they were a highly competitive 5 seed that went down to the last minute with a team with James Harden and Russell Westbrook. I don't think that the Bulls have those kind of leaders on the court. They don't have those experienced guys who take them up a level, and they don't have a Chris Paul. They don't have a Danilo Gallinari unless Markkanen takes that big step up, and still they don't have the experience. So I guess that he sees a higher ceiling than what I cynically am not seeing right now because of how the past couple years have gone.
The biggest question I think he's going to have to answer is what does his backcourt look like, right? Because Kobe White had the really strong end of the year. Zach LaVine is a player that I have often said seems to be a guy that when he is doing better, his team is doing worse. That makes sense. And yeah, like you said, there was atrophy in the front court. You got really excited about Wendell Carter and Lauri Markkanen after their rookie years, but they haven't taken the necessary step forward. In fact, it appears that they've taken the step back. So he's got these clogs with ball dominant guards and two guys who may be centers or power forward tweener guys. How does he sort that out? What is the best ecosystem for this team?
Well, I think that Carter and Markkanen can coexist.
I do too.
In their best versions, they can be fantastic together because they both, if they maximize their potential, can have that floor spacing ability. Obviously, it's obvious with Markkanen and Carter flash a little bit of that outside shooting ability at Duke, and maybe he can stabilize there. Carter has a little bit of that playmaking out of the post. He's a great defensive player. So that, to me, is not an issue if they both end up being good, productive basketball players. LaVine and Kobe White, there is no way they can coexist. They are two of the most ball-dominant, Eyes only on the bucket, guys who have that sort of star billing in the league. And obviously Coby White isn't a star yet, but he certainly thinks he's a star. The guy shoots every time that he touches the ball. And through the first 4 months of the season, he almost never made those shots. Then he got really hot for a month. I don't think that necessarily means that he had a successful rookie campaign, though. And I think that a lot of people are erasing all of the terrible things that we saw from him for most of this season just because he got on a hot streak to end the year. And I don't think that really shows that he improved. It's just he's a gifted shot maker and he's going to make shots. So I don't like Coby White all that much. At the same time, he's 20 years old and Zach LaVine is 25, and you really know what you're getting from Zach LaVine. So maybe it's just out of that endless optimism that exists in NBA franchises where you have to believe in something. Maybe they move on from LaVine and hope that Coby White is the guy, because maybe there's more of a ceiling there. I don't think either of them can be your primary ball handlers, though, just because they're largely incapable as passers, and LaVine has progressed there. Really just specific reads out of the pick and roll, though. He's not the kind of guy who's going to make any advanced passes out there. Coby White probably has some room to grow there because, again, he is so young. But they're not going to be together long-term. There's just no way. If Coby White's coming off the bench this coming year and he's their spark plug guy who tries to get them 15 a game in 20-something minutes, that's fine, and that's an okay role for him early in his career.
Sure.
But long-term, if these two guys you're billing as your star talents, one of them is going to have to go.
So is this a team at all that could get into a Giannis sweepstakes and maybe make a play that way, or no, absolutely not?
You are really optimistic on the Chicago Bulls big-time free agents.
Listen, I never said that they would, but it is a top-three market that seems to play some factor. Michael Jordan played there, but
I can't see it.
I can't either. I was just asking you.
They've been too dysfunctional for too long. The players at the core of this, again, Zach LaVine, who I think is a spectacle to watch for. I love
it's the awesome.
Range artists. I'm effusive about that, and he is one of the best in the league. Obviously dynamic athletically, got a fun handle to watch, an athletic finisher around the rim. That's all fantastic, but at the same time, he's a minus defensively, who again is largely a poor decision maker, and is quasi-efficient as far as getting buckets, and it often doesn't come within the flow of the game, and he takes his teammates out of it. I don't know why Giannis would want to go play with that. I mean, we talk about him needing a high-level perimeter shot maker to take the team up a notch, and that's true, but Chris Middleton's better at that than Zach LaVine when it comes to actually winning games because of the playmaking and the defense. So I don't see that upside. I would need to see a lot of progress from the Bulls as an organization and from the individual players if I'm a star before I even think about going there, because things have been so bad for so long.
Yeah. I am certainly grasping at straws because I'm trying to wrap my head around why Billy Donovan chose this organization, because it feels weird. It doesn't feel right. We will get into some other coaching debates on the other side of a break. This is Fox Sports Knoxville, WKGN Fan Run Radio. Run It Up continues after this. If you're... Run It Up on a Tuesday night. We've got Carson Preber on the phone rounding things out as we head into the home stretch here from the White Claw Studios at Fox Sports Knoxville. Carson, we just got done talking about a pretty confusing choice by Billy Donovan to join an organization in the Bulls to be their next head coach. That team is not in the bubble, though. There are four coaches left in the NBA playoffs, and I want to talk about those guys before later in the hour we get into some stuff about LeBron's legacy ahead of their game with the Nuggets. I believe that's set to tip off here in about 10 minutes, if it hasn't already. And then we'll talk about the state of basketball as a whole, as for the first time, really, they find themselves at their peak hour competing with football. But first, like I said, we'll start with the coaching stuff. So a lot has been made of the coaching matchup in the East with Spoelstra and Stevens, and rightfully so. Those are two fantastic coaches. But I want to focalize for a moment more so in the West, because so many coaches in the career of LeBron James have been these afterthoughts that were thought to not necessarily have a ton of impact, aside from really Spo, on what's actually happening on the floor. And Vogel has made some sneaky but interesting choices throughout this postseason. How would you appraise his coaching job so far in this series against the Nuggets and so far in general with the Lakers?
Well, it's been interesting. And the most surprising part about how he's handled this series is something that we talked about in great detail, how we expected he would go the other direction. He's played two big men for pretty significant minutes. He's played JaVale and Dwight both alongside Anthony Davis for pretty good stretches of all of these games thus far. And it's interesting because it seems like the real motive there is that he wants to avoid AD guarding Jokic, because as I'm watching now, JaVale just got in foul trouble, and even though they're playing essentially four wings alongside AD, pretty small guys, they're still not putting AD on Jokic, and Jokic is just picking them apart like that. So that's a little bit perplexing to me. It's not like AD can stop him, as we saw
right.
in Game 2, where Jokic just bullied him down to 4 feet from the basket and put a hook up over him like it was nothing. But it's certainly, he's certainly a better bet than whoever else you have out there, than Kyle Kuzma, or even then your true big men like Dwight Howard or JaVale McGee. I think that we saw it be particularly effective in Game 1 more offensively, because one of the great weaknesses in this Nuggets team is that they don't have a rim protector. And so when you have not only LeBron and AD out there, but also a lob threat like Dwight Howard, who's aggressively going downhill again and again against a tentative defense, that's going to be pretty effective. So Dwight was feasting off that a little bit. And then we saw last game, it was sort of neutral. Dwight played some good defense, also picked up a lot of fouls. And in this one, I'm not sure. I still don't think that it works out long term. So that is the most distinctive decision that he's made. I still don't know if his hand has been forced by Anthony Davis not wanting to be a center in there. If so, what a fascinating man AD is, and I would really like to understand why
What's
he
the difference?
Cares so much about that. But I think that Vogel has done a pretty solid job of coaching all around, and I think that when you look at him maximizing the talent of this roster, it's tough to say how much of that motivation goes to him versus leaders within the team, specifically LeBron James, who seems to unlock ceilings of these bygone stars like Rondo, like Dwight Howard, guys who haven't been productive for a few years and all of a sudden are playing well. Of course, they're also more in the spotlight. It's not like Dwight Howard's doing anything exceptional, and in fact, Rondo was bad for much of this year, but those are two guys who are playing really well right now. So I think that some credit goes to Vogel for understanding how to utilize them, particularly Dwight, and getting him to buy into that, because Dwight is a guy who for so long resisted his role as just a rim runner, rim protector, wanted to be a post scorer, even though he sucked at it. And now he's finally embraced that. Rondo at times seems to still think that he's a little bit more of the man than he really is, wants to run the offense, but for the most part in the biggest spots when they've needed him, he's been good. So I think that Vogel isn't a schematic genius, but what he is he's a guy who gets teams to play great team defense, as he did with those Indiana teams, as he's done throughout his entire coaching career, and establishes a bit of a culture. And of course, LeBron plays a bigger part in that, but Vogel has done that, and we'll see if the two big men strategy pays off for him throughout this series, because Game 1 was a strange one. Game 2 was far from a convincing victory by the Lakers, really a 50-50 outcome. And this one is off to a pretty tight start as well.
Well, and we talk a lot about culture, and you can say what you want. Obviously, having Anthony Davis has been a large part of establishing one that is centered around winning, which is going to help any team's culture. We're never going to talk about the fantastic culture of a losing team. We're just not going to do that. But say what you will, they had LeBron James last year, and the culture of the team was apparently not very good. Vogel has to get some credit for managing that, right?
I totally agree. I do think, though, we have to acknowledge that it was a different context. LeBron was not really in championship mode, because I think that he knew that was not on the table with that roster. And so I think that he has been a different level of locked in. Like, he was willing to just sort of take the end of the season off last year. I don't know that he necessarily had to miss the last 27 games or whatever with injury, but he did because they didn't really matter. So, yes, it's on LeBron from that season for not being fully locked in, but at the same time, you got to understand context. I do agree. Vogel, I do think, has played a role in that, and he deserves to be commended for it, and again, it's one of his strengths as a coach, but I also think that above all else, LeBron is the culture setter because he's LeBron James, and Frank Vogel, in a lot of ways, could be a number of other people out there, and it would be a similar effect. LeBron is obviously irreplaceable.
Yeah, I'll just give credit to Vogel in the sense that I think he's had a larger role in this team than a guy like Ty Lue or some of the other coaches that LeBron James has had, at least from a schematic standpoint.
And he's a better, more experienced coach than those guys.
Sure.
He's the most successful coach on his own merits that LeBron has had in a very long time. Like, go throughout his entire career. Mike Brown, was not a particularly successful coach individually. David Blatt, obviously, had never been an NBA coach. Ty Lue had never been an NBA head coach. Eric Spoelstra had only been an NBA coach for a couple of seasons before LeBron went there. Vogel's a guy who led a team to back-to-back Eastern Conference Finals and has coached a lot of good NBA basketball in his career. So you have a higher expectation from him. Even though it's not a huge name signing, by the standards of LeBron coaches, he's the guy who's done the most without LeBron.
I'm trying to think, is Spo the first coach that LeBron has had that has remained the coach of said team after LeBron has not been there?
I'm pretty sure.
And I think that speaks volumes about what organizations feel about those coaches, because if LeBron James isn't going to be there, they need a completely different type of guy that can win with less. And I think that's true. Vogel is the first guy where I'd say, okay, that may not be the case. They could keep Frank Vogel around if LeBron decided to split and go somewhere else. I don't know where he'd go, but I think that is the case there. Let's talk about what Mike Malone's done, though, for a second here. How has your thought process been about how he's tried to counter the Lakers and what they've been doing playing with the two bigs?
Well, I think that he honestly hasn't done anything that exceptional as far as countering that, and I think that's why we've seen it kind of work. And personnel-wise, on the defensive end, there really is nothing he can do. He's not going to play Plumlee and Jokic together, so he's not going to be able to have that rim protector, that counter to Dwight or a second big man who's physically imposing. And I think that offensively, you know, the Nuggets, just within the flow of the game, because Nikola Jokic is out there, try to expose that Lakers defense is a little bit slower, can't quite be as quick on those rotations. And I think that they've done a fine job of that. Nothing game-changing. Mike Malone's an interesting coach to me for other reasons, though, because this is a guy who has had to work with so many more different rotations throughout the playoffs than other guys do, because he has so many wings who are not clearly defined as stars. He could close with Gary Harris or Torrey Craig or Michael Porter Jr. or P.J. Dozier, even, for that fifth spot alongside.
Yeah, that was weird that he chose to do that in game two.
It was weird, but at the same time, Dozier was playing pretty well, and he's a guy who gives you effort defensively, has some playmaking instincts on the offensive end. I don't really understand it. It scares me. He's certainly not afraid of the moment, though, although he did miss four free throws, but he's the kind of guy who likes to have the ball in his hands. So that's been a fascinating balancing act for me from Malone. And again, if we're talking about motivating players, who deserves more credit than the guy whose team has come back from 3-1 down twice? A guy who you were ready to call for his head if they had lost in the first round, in somewhat deservedly so, because that would have been a huge disappointment from this team. So I think that what's interesting is when you look at the Eastern Conference, it's these two schematic geniuses. Whereas on the Western Conference, it's more culture setters, guys, leaders. And obviously Spoelstra is an incredible leader as well. He's the full package. That's why he's one of the 10 best coaches of all time. But I don't think Malone has done anything exceptional, because think about the structure of this offense. It's so simple. It's more Jokic pick and roll again and again. Put solid shooters around them. Those guys will benefit from the offense created by your two stars, and that's it. There's no question about who you're going to in crunch time. The only question you have is, where are you filling that last wing spot with? And it's been interesting to see how he's handled that. There hasn't been a consistent choice, and we'll see if one of those guys is able to step up and really assert themselves in these last few games now, because no one really has.
So you touched there on an interesting point. I would say pretty confidently that three of the top four coaches now in the NBA are in the Eastern Conference, at least from a tactician standpoint. In Nick Nurse, Brad Stevens, and Eric Spoelstra, with the fourth guy being somewhere mixed in there, Steve Kerr.
Yes.
By how much would you prefer, if you were the owner of a team, to have one of the two coaches that are in the Eastern Conference Finals right now than the two coaches that are in the West?
I think it's a pretty significant margin. And I remember back when there was a debate on the national outlets, like First Take did a segment on how many players would you take before Brad Stevens. And I think Max Kellerman said like 10, which was obviously ridiculous.
Yeah, it's Max Kellerman. What do you expect?
It's Max Kellerman, and yeah, they're doing whatever they can for ratings. These are two of the four best coaches in basketball. You're absolutely right. And it's not just that they're great schematically, because we have seen these guys win their team's games with coaching, which is pretty rare. Obviously, Nick Nurse is a guy who does that regularly. Steve Kerr is a guy who We look at the overwhelming talent. He won his team a title by entirely changing the scheme. Steph Curry was a high-volume pick-and-roll point guard, and obviously Kerr completely rewrote that, so he deserves tremendous credit for that. But it's interesting because I don't think that Vogel, I really don't think that Vogel is the kind of overwhelming voice in the room. I think that Malone is pretty strong leadership from the top, but Spoelstra certainly provides that. I think that Stevens, in his own way, is a culture setter, and just the fact that he has the Celtics organization helps establish that as well. So I think that those guys are in a completely different tier. I picked Mike Malone to win Coach of the Year coming into the season because I thought the Nuggets were going to have that team success, but that's not because of any schematic brilliance. That's just because oftentimes Coach of the Year goes to the guy who is the team that overperforms, and it doesn't really matter what he's doing X and O's-wise. Otherwise, the same coaches would win for the most part every year. So I think that there's a big difference between the caliber of coaches in these two conferences, which I think is interesting because if you look at the Celtics and the Heat, those are two teams that, for the most part, people didn't expect to see here, and yet they have, especially for the Heat, overperformed. The Nuggets are the same thing, but I think it's been more reliant on just those incredible performances from their two stars, not as much from anything from the coach.
All right, so that was the coaching talk. After the break, we'll talk about LeBron and what a win in the bubble could potentially mean for his legacy, as well as some discussion about where the league stands in perpetuity to football and the rest of the sports, because a lot of people like to say that the NBA is coming for the NFL, and I don't know if what we've seen so far this fall would indicate anything akin to that trend. That's all coming up on the other end of a break, but we do have to take one right now. WKGM Fox Sports Knoxville Fan Run Radio. Run it up. We're winding down here in the home stretch. 20 minutes left in the program on a Tuesday. There is NBA basketball tonight. There was not last night. The game involves LeBron James at an interesting juncture in his career. Again, of course, we are joined, as always, when we talk about basketball by Carson Breber, who's on the phone line with us, co-host of the Nerd Sesh podcast, which you can find on all podcasting platforms. It is a good time. And Carson, I want to focus with you for a moment on LeBron James and what this postseason could mean to how we look at him down the road, his legacy, what we will tell our kids about LeBron James. So you read a monologue I gave earlier a couple weeks ago about what this means for LeBron. And in that, I said that this would be a touchstone moment for him because this would be him overcoming a great deal of adversity, something that he has struggled with throughout his career. Do you generally agree with that stance?
Absolutely. I mean, this is not the signature title of his career, but clearly the second most significant because he's doing it with only one signature guy alongside him as opposed to two, which he had for each of his first three titles, and a supporting cast that was kind of just thrown together in obviously not really his first year with this team, but essentially his first year with this core because Anthony Davis wasn't on the Lakers last year, at 35 years old, and really the only truly elite regular season team that has stood the test of the bubble and that has not underachieved because, of course, the Clippers were knocked out, the Bucks were knocked out, the Raptors were knocked out, and those were really the only other teams that people were picking to make the finals or possibly even win the title. So, of course, this is hugely significant, especially because he's still the best player on this team. The guy's averaging 26, 10, and 9, and he's the best player in the world. So now you're getting into really rarefied air with people who have been on that list. Best player on championship teams at 35, it's Michael Jordan, and I can't think of very many others. In fact, I'm not sure that I can think of any others who have also been the best player in the world when doing that. So that's special. I think that people are overly eager to knight LeBron as the greatest player of all time because they can't understand that which they haven't seen with their own eyes. And it's just so hilarious to me how generational the divide in the GOAT argument is. It's people who have seen Michael Jordan think Michael Jordan is the GOAT. People who haven't seen Michael Jordan think LeBron is the GOAT because LeBron is what they know. And, you know, all the power to those people, but I just think that it's a misguided argument. However, when you pull off something like this, he's deservingly asserted himself to me as clearly the second guy in that conversation. Kareem has the accolades, but at the same time, Kareem had Magic Johnson for the better part of a decade and only won one title without him, and no other top five player of all time except for Magic himself, who had Kareem, has had a running mate like that. So that's certainly advantageous. LeBron has never had that. To do it in three different spots under these circumstances in the bubble would be pretty remarkable. And people try to discredit the route that he's taken there. Of course, it's less impressive to beat the Nuggets than the Clippers just when you're looking at the talent on paper. But, of course, the Nuggets also beat the Clippers. They deserve to be here. He eviscerated a Rockets team that was obviously incredibly talented and hyped up. People got way too high on the Trailblazers. That was hilarious to watch in the moment for me, people expecting that series to be really competitive. But at the same time, that was a team on fire with a spectacular star at the top of it, and he eviscerated them. And whoever comes out of the East, I hope it's the Celtics, because I think that's the more talented team and by far the more entertaining matchup. That's going to be an impressive victory as well. Just because he's not going up against some all-time Spurs, Warriors talent, that's not how the history of the NBA has been. You don't always have a dynasty going up against another dynasty or another top five player of all time. Through the 70s, we had back-to-back Sonics-Bullets finals. Yep. And if you go through the 80s, you know, in 86, the Celtics beat the Rockets. Sometimes it was Lakers-Sixers. It wasn't always Lakers-Celtics. If you look at the Pistons back-to-back titles, you know, the Blazers got to a couple finals back in their day. So I think it's important to remember that just because we had four straight years of Warriors-Cavs and that there have been such clear dynasties at the top of this sport for so many years, that doesn't in any way discredit this title from LeBron, which I think is the argument that some people are making. Meanwhile, on the opposite side, people blindly defending him are saying it's one of the toughest routes to a title. And I think that we just, as a basketball community, need to come to some sort of common ground and understand that LeBron can be great without being the greatest of all time by far every single time he does anything.
Yeah, and that is my problem with this whole debate. Is like many of the things in our country right now, there apparently is not allowed to be any middle ground. And I'm not going to get off into the weeds about any political diatribe here. But there is a middle ground. And I'm not going to be one of those people who says they're both great. Why can't we just appreciate both their greatnesses? Because that's also stupid. You just don't want to have the debate. Okay, cool.
That's not what we do. We move to debate.
We embrace debate. But there's a difference between best and greatest. And LeBron James is probably the best natural basketball player to date. Best rounded skill set, best physical domination of the game. He can do things physically that Jordan couldn't. But Jordan is the greatest because there was a six-season run, 8 years in total, where he literally could not be beat. He was not beaten. We have seen LeBron James lose. He is so much less impervious than Jordan was, because from listening to people talk about it, who were there, and of course, we're both in our 20s, so it's not necessarily, well, I'm in my 20s. I don't even believe you've crested 20 years old yet.
That's correct.
So when we talk about it, we're talking about it from a secondhand perspective, of course. Mm-hmm. But LeBron has never seemed unbeatable the way that Jordan seems to have. And the moments that Jordan has created, LeBron simply has not. So in the conversation of who is the GOAT, operative word, greatest of all time, greatness is about being able to conjure moments of this pure magic, this unthinkable spark of brilliance that LeBron simply has had fewer of than Jordan. So I think the argument ends there, right? But with that said, he's not just competing against the Miami Heat or the Boston Celtics to win a championship, right? Although, that is a feat in and of itself, because the teams that we thought as chief competitors, the Bucks and the Raptors, well, you know what? They had to lose to somebody, which means that team is probably pretty good, too. So, I'm not taking anything away from the Celtics or the Heat. But, he's having to compete with the fact that this would be the worst roster that he's ever won a title with. And, he's competing against the situation itself, the bubble. So, in that regard, That's not necessarily a notch in the belt that Jordan can claim that he overcame this kind of situational adversity. What would that for you mean for LeBron's legacy in juxtaposition to Jordan?
Well, I think that it's an accomplishment for LeBron. I don't know how much it can factor into that debate, though, because who knows how Michael Jordan would have handled the bubble. We're never going to have a bubble again. That's one time in history.
Hopefully.
Who knows how Kareem would have handled the bubble, or Magic, or Larry Bird. So I don't think that that's necessarily all that significant, but what it does show is overcoming adversity to begin with. And obviously that is part of the incredible mystique around Michael Jordan. What I will say, though, is I don't think this argument comes down to great moments. LeBron is lacking in that compared to Michael Jordan, undeniably, because Jordan has hit several series-winning shots. Well,
and, hey, not to cut you off, but by the way, so is every athlete in the history of sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but my point is just I think that Jordan's resume is greater on its own merit. And when you talk about the quote-unquote best all-around player of all time, first of all, I think that it's really difficult to compare skill sets from between generations because you can only compare people to their peers, in my opinion. People are constantly evolving, getting better. Skill is improving in the sport. People are still evolving physically. Athletes are better now than they were 20-something years ago. And also, Jordan had things that he could do that were just unstoppable. The guy won 10 scoring titles in 11 healthy seasons in Chicago. So, yes, it's incredibly valuable that LeBron can get you 25 and 10. If Jordan can get you 40 every time, that doesn't necessarily matter. But to the point about what this would mean for LeBron's legacy, I think it would be huge. And I think that's undeniable because those first two titles in Miami, of course they count. They're fantastic. They're incredible accomplishments. But obviously they're not quite as exciting when he joins a team and guarantees not one, not two, not three, et cetera, et cetera. And the expectation is that they win every year and only win two out of four. That's a little bit different than putting together this ragtag squad, overcoming incredibly odd circumstances when it wasn't even certain that there was going to be a season to end it. So I don't think that the GOAT conversation should be driven by narrative and moments. I am opposed to things like that. I think that we can look at resumes, and that is how these decisions should be made. At the same time, this is a huge moment, and both in narrative and in actual accomplishments, this is a tremendous opportunity for LeBron to enhance his legacy even more.
Right, and I don't necessarily disagree with anything that you just said. And the moments thing, it is subjective, I will admit that. And a lot of it is circumstantial and situational. LeBron hasn't had an opportunity to, with the flu or food poisoning or whatever you want to say about that, have a playoff game like that. We haven't seen him get this opportunity, and likewise, we never saw Jordan play in a bubble exactly like you said. So it is hard to quantify that kind of thing. And, of course, we've seen LeBron James hit plenty of game winners in the playoffs. It just doesn't feel like that stuff is quite as indelible as it seems like some of those moments, like the shot, which was in a series that ended up being kind of meaningless against the Cavs, like those moments were. You know, we don't think about his shot against the Pacers a couple years ago in that same kind of light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that part of that is just the majestic basketball skill of Michael Jordan. The fact that it's the kind of shot that he takes. You know, a LeBron game winner, if it's that sort of rigid step back three or if it's getting downhill, it's not the same as a majestic Jordan fadeaway or pull up or the shot that he ended his career on when he's crossing and then hitting that mid-range jumper. And the man also levitated, which makes for incredible slow motion video because it's like you're watching twice the length of a normal highlight. So there is always going to be that air around Jordan that I don't think anyone can ever match. Because the guy was an infallible scorer, and that's the most dramatic thing that there is on the basketball court, and he did it in such a beautiful way. So just to that point, I don't think LeBron's ever going to be able to beat Jordan in that sense.
Right. We've got about 10 minutes here. I did want to get into a discussion about where basketball resides right now. I don't think have enough time to do that justice, so we've got an hour with nothing planned tomorrow. If you're game, I'm game. We can do that on tomorrow's show. Let's keep talking about this LeBron situation in the postseason this year and what it means for him. Do you agree with me when I say that it feels like this year LeBron has gotten way less publicity in terms of the playoff coverage than he has in past years when he seems to be the only story that really matters?
Yeah, I think that's probably true because there's been so many shocking outcomes. A lot of people didn't expect the Bucks to go down. Nobody expected the Nuggets to do what they've done. There's been the ascension of these stars, obviously, particularly in Denver with Jamal Murray. The Clippers' collapse was its incredibly interesting own narrative. So even though this is one of the more unique playoff teams that LeBron has carried under incredibly strange circumstances, I think that you're right. Compared to other years, he has not been the main story for the most part. Sometimes with even within his own team, because AD has been so spectacular. So it's interesting. At the same time, when we get to the finals, you know that that's going to be all that people are really focused on. People might entertain the idea of the upstart, you know, younger Celtics or the scrappy Heat winning the title, and that will be fun for a couple games. But if LeBron and the Lakers assert themselves, it's all going to become legacy talk. And more than anything else, it's going to be about the greatness of LeBron James.
And I'm not just even going to assume that the Lakers get there, because Denver gave them a really good game in Game 2. They're up by double digits right now in Game 3. But let's assume that the Lakers do get there. And I think we both are the camp that believe, as much as you love the Nuggets, that that is the eventuality. Mm-hmm. If he becomes another great Laker that beats a Celtics team, even if it is the Celtics team, does that do anything for you?
It's complicated because obviously the history there is incredible. Jerry West, Elgin Baylor never beat a Celtics team. You have the 80s rivalry. You have Kobe versus Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen and the boys. At the same time, I do think that that's dependent on the greatness of those teams. You go back to the 60s Celtics, it's the greatest dynasty in the history of American sports. You go to the 80s Celtics, obviously with one of the 10 signature players in the history of this sport, a top five dynasty of all time. Even if you go to the late 2010s, that was an era when, you know, if you go through some of the 2000s, there's not really that established dominant team. You go Pistons, Spurs, Heat, Spurs for the titles in between the Lakers dominance and then the Spurs 1 and 03, all the way to that Lakers-Celtics rivalry, which begins in 08. So I think that the legacy of those teams is a little bit more pronounced because they filled a gap when there hadn't been that dynasty, and even though they only played in two finals, it felt like more, and that was emboldened by the fact that it was these two franchises. If it's the Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Kemba Walker Celtics in their first appearance in the finals, I don't know that that necessarily carries the same weight. It's obviously more fun. At the same time, can it ever be considered in the same realm as those other Celtics-Lakers rivalries? I don't think so, because those are multiple final series. Those are so many all-time players on both ends, and you can't account for that in one series. So I don't know if it holds any particular weight in this context. However, the Celtics, to me, are going to be the presumptive favorite out of the East going forward, assuming nothing insane happens.
Which is ridiculous, considering they're down 2-1, but I don't know if you're crazy for thinking that.
Yeah, I mean, I just look at the talent on this roster, and these are guys who are going to continue to improve and are already at that level where they could very well make the finals, and there are very few teams in the league who can say that, where their best player is 22 years old and is presumably going to be a lot better a few years down the road. So that's why I have that faith in the Celtics. If LeBron can stick around enough and AD can continue to keep this team special, a Celtics-Lakers rivalry part four would be one of my favorite things in my basketball lifetime, because it's just so awesome. And if we happened upon it for yet another time, add another chapter to that 30 for 30, that would be incredible.
Yeah, and this word maybe is a little bit overused and colloquialized, but I mean this in the Greek sense. It would be an epic to see that happen again now here in the 2020s. I personally think the Heat will come out of the East just because I think they are a tougher team. I think they, oddly enough, are playing like they've been here before, when in fact the Celtics have that on their resume and the Heat don't. I also think they present a more competitive matchup for the Lakers just because of their personnel. If they beat the Heat in a 6 or 7 game series, LeBron beating his old team in the finals, I can't remember the last time a player beat their former team in a final series like that. What would that do for you?
Well, I don't know if that's all that significant, because obviously he has his established legacy there, and I think that that will go down as the less impressive finals victory, because people will look at that roster many years from now, and they will see a third-year Bam Adebayo or Jimmy Butler as the best player on a finals team versus Jason Tatum, who I think we can assume will continue to ascend to superstardom, and a few years down the road will probably be a top-5 guy in the league, and people may look back at this team and assume that he was at that level already, especially if he plays well in that series. There's more recognizable stars, there's more talent on this team, so I think that there's more, and it's not a huge legacy boost, because obviously it's a title either way, the circumstances don't change, the Lakers roster don't change. I do think it would be slightly more impressive and memorable if it was the Celtics, because I expect them to stick around more and have the potential to maybe get a championship or two of their own, whereas mm-hmm. I don't really see that for the Heat. And yes, it's cool to beat your old team. At the same time, it feels like so many ages ago that LeBron was on the Heat, because obviously Truly. There was a cast, and even between then, we've seen the Heat go through multiple versions of their team in the years since then. So there's the consistency of having Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra, but outside of that, the Heat are not the organization that LeBron is going to be remembered as a member of. I think that probably by the end of his career, even though he'll end with the most rings as a member of the Miami Heat, it'll go Cavs, Lakers, just because they're the Lakers and everyone's remembered as a Laker. Wilt's remembered as a Laker, even though he only spent 5 years of his career there or whatever. And then the Heat will be last of that group. And for that reason, I mean, if he were beating the Cavs, oh my God, that would feel monumental if they somehow put together a competent, elite basketball roster. The Heat, it's not quite that same feeling to me.
Yeah, they're really going to need Chetty Osmond to accelerate his timetable a little bit if they're going to get
Chetty
there.
Chetty could be LeBron. Big man, playmaking, some shooting stroke.
Sure.
I can see it.
Darius Garland can be Kyrie. But digressing from that, final thoughts on where we're at right now with LeBron James and this Lakers team. I want to focus in on this team that he's playing with, aside from Anthony Davis, because they've got the two top five players, and I'm ready to put Anthony Davis there. Now, I wasn't convinced coming into the bubble. I am now. He's a top five player. I don't think Dwayne Wade was at that point whenever LeBron got there. It was really the first time he's played with a top five guy, but also in every series that the Lakers have been a part of, three of the top five players in that series have been on the other team because the supporting cast is not that great for the Lakers. So how do you deal with the dichotomy of, yes, he's playing with this top five player, but also this is the worst total roster that he probably would have ever won a championship with?
Well, I think that's what makes it most impressive. And I would push back and say that Dwayne Wade was a top five player in their first season together. I mean, he was a legitimate co-star, averaging 25-plus a game, by far leading them in scoring in the finals. And there was, believe it or not, that debate of that, you know, push and shove and who's really going to take this team over. But as far as having multiple seasons as a top five guy, AD's the only one with that potential. And that is what makes this so incredible. Because when you go to the 2010-11 Miami Heat, yes, they had the big three. Yes, they had D-Wade as a top five guy. But they didn't win the title because they didn't have the right pieces assembled around them, and it was kind of thrown together, and it was like, let's just get whoever we can besides those guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the same feeling this year, but it's working to the point where they may win a title, and that's easily more impressive. The fact that he hasn't engineered this roster in the same way where, you know, he had two stars come with him to Miami, and he joined two stars in Cleveland. Now it's just AD, and it's whatever else they can get together, and it's working as well as anything else that they've ever done. That, to me, is certainly more impressive, and it's more interesting because I don't think people like the construction of those super teams, and even though LeBron and AD are two guys who previously weren't on the Lakers and then came over there to join forces, it just feels a little cleaner, a little more authentic. He also spent his year suffering a little bit and paying his dues on a team that wasn't very good. So I do think that it's more impressive in some ways, and I think that also people will embrace it more because it feels more traditional and sort of wholesome in a way.
All right, Carson Brebber, thank you for coming on tonight. This has been Run It Up. We're going to get out of here. We'll get back at it again tomorrow. Run It Back tomorrow. Thank you guys for listening.